This is The Conversation. It's episode 109 with Marco Rios. I'm Michael Shaw, and the website for the show is theconversationpod.com. Marco is a heavily installation-based artist. He is also a curator, and so you're going to hear what it's like being on both sides shortly. First, I wanted to start by mentioning that it does feel like I've been getting a nice little trickle of feedback from listeners out there in various locations, local and beyond. And I want to say how gratifying and I'm grateful I am for getting that communique, whether it's an email or social media or a card in one case. I got both my first check as opposed to a PayPal donation, and it came with a card, and I'm very grateful for that. That was very gratifying to receive. So if you're out there and you are listening and you have the time and the stamina to break away from the computer or break away from your listening or finish this episode by running over the computer and letting me know who you are and where you are, I would be happy to hear from you. And just by way of context, I will tell you that there's another podcast, which I won't mention the name of, that I am a very big fan of, and whose host I have contacted a few times. He encourages feedback and, listener communication. He also offers surveys, which is something, a stage I haven't quite gotten to yet. But in any case, I have contacted him a few times. He's gotten back to me every time, but his responses have been, like one of those one sentence, one line type responses. So pretty unsatisfying. I think I've given up on him in that regard. But all that to say that if you contact me, I promise I will give you a very satisfying response, whether it is in electronic or written form. So that's something to look forward to. If you do, let me know that you're listening. What else? Oh, before we get to Marco, I just wanted to also request, if you don't mind, as a way to help more people find the show, is iTunes, actually. It's the platform iTunes. Even if you are listening to this as streaming on Stitcher or some other platform other than iTunes, if you just go to iTunes, which is linked through theconversationpod.com, and subscribe to the show. The Conversation, an Artist Podcast, as the original name of the show was back in the day. That will help as well if you leave a review, and a nice review, hopefully, and a nice rating in stars, 5 stars. That will also help more people find the show, apparently. So let's give that a go if we could, and we'll get more new listeners. I love hearing from new listeners that have just found the show. And by the way, there are now 108 episodes prior to this one that you can go listen to of varying styles, so in terms of format. So just FYI. All right, let's get to Marco. Marco is an artist curator and artist curator, and let's find out how he gets carried off into the sunset right now. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end. This is The Conversation live, and I'm joined, thankfully, once again by Deb Cloudman.
Yay. Lovely to be here.
And we are joined by our guest, Marco Rios.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Marco and Deb have just met for the first time, so that should provide several awkward moments, which we're looking forward to exploring.
We'll do our best.
Marco, there's so many places we could start with you, but as I've alluded to in talking to you previously, I'm definitely interested in finding out, and I think people are interested in hearing about the artist curator dilemma.
Uh-huh.
I know that's just such a negative framing, but but when I think one of the sort of associations that come with that, just from my own limited experience, mm-hmm. is thinking about the process of doing a group show with a number of different artists and all the different types of dynamics that are involved in that.
Yeah. Do you want me to give you like the lowdown how it actually happened?
Tell us how. So, well, first of all, tell us your title at Cal State LA.
I'm the the gallery curator at the Luckman Gallery, part of the Luckman Fine Arts Complex on the Cal State LA campus. And I'd been working there since 2001. And my predecessor, her name was Julie Joyce, and she was the wife of my high school art teacher.
That's awesome.
And who was also a professional working painter, and just recently showed with Angles, and his name was Adam Ross. So that was kind of like a unique thing to go to high school.
So Adam Ross and Julie Joyce are married.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me just interject for a second, because so you've been at Luckman since 2001?
Yeah, but not like full time.
She was the director in 2001 up through like 2004.
Probably, I would say, I'm not sure exactly when, but maybe like 99, 2000.
The reason I'm asking about dates is because I remember going to hear Jack Goldstein speak there.
Okay, yeah.
And that was like 2003, I think.
Yeah, no, she was probably there probably 2 years before I would help her out, because at the time I had worked for a private collector.
Can you say who that is?
Sure, yeah, it was Peter Norton. I worked for the Peter Norton Collection, he and his wife were like, Eileen Norton, were heavily collecting at that time. Mm-hmm. And then 9/11 happened, and then like a week later, I think he had taken a hit, and like some of the staff were let go like the following week. And so that's how I know as a bookmark, like when I started working for the Luckman more regularly. Right. And that was like I think people have the impression like, oh my God, you worked there that long? Like, but it wasn't like full time. I just sort of like assisted her and kind of wore many hats. And
but then, that's how you got the job, because you knew her through.
Yeah. And then, well, connection. I also had a really good reputation of, designing like boxes and for like artwork for travel, and like, and I actually kind of got off on it, you know, like designing like traveling systems for specific artworks that were like really
the precision kind,
yeah,
of,
yeah, the precision, yeah. Like, I mean, there was a point where I get calls from New York just to say like, how did you do that?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, you know,
so you're,
this
so you're,
is beautiful.
So you're both a carpentry guru and a carpentry geek, would you say?
I wouldn't say a geek, but like, because I had prior to that, I had worked at a fine art photography place off of La Brea, and it was more sort of commercial photography. And so, yeah, I just kind of got off on really, really expensive prints. I had to like travel international, and I guess the person who'd worked there before, oftentimes these things would get damaged, and
right.
So yeah. It was kind of like I would design these systems, and then and for a while, I would get like a lot of freelance work to, you know, for people that couldn't go through like a finite shipping company where the prices are like astronomical, right. That I would like design like crates or shipping methods. And for a very weird period, there was, what's the guy's name in Pulp Fiction? Like the Harvey Keitel character, the fixer. That's kind of what I felt like. Like somehow my number would get passed around and I would get these random calls, sometimes from New York, and like, I get a call and the guy like, we got, you know, your number, and I could never find out the original source, but they're like, we heard you can help us.
This is who we call for the impossible problems.
Yeah, and then like, and so then they would just give me like an address, and they were like, we are in desperate need of help. We need you to go to this person's studio and like get their shit together, and like this, there's a shipment happening, and she's flipping out, and we need you to go over there and like make this happen.
That
and
sounds would, great, having that kind of attention.
Yeah, no, it was cool, because it was like really kind of cool, easy money and stuff, but. And it was always kind of like, there was always great stories to tell. Like, I've transported artworks that weren't supposed to be known, like on an airplane, been paid to like sit on my lap. And like, no, it's been crazy. I've definitely had some like adventures.
You had a sculpture sitting on your lap for a flight?
Yeah, like because it couldn't travel through the normal way through like fine art shipping company.
Yeah, yeah. This
artwork wasn't supposed to have been known that it was being sold. And so I was like, all right, yeah, I'll do it.
So getting back to then how you became the curator.
So basically I'd worked closely with like Julie, and she was like amazing to work for because her husband was an artist. She kind of she got it. And so, you know, as long as it didn't like conflict with work, for the most part, she let me kind of you know, do what I wanted. If, like, if I needed to travel for my own work or whatever, like, she was always amazing. And then in 2009, while I was doing the residency, which I mentioned to you at the Exploratorium, she called me and told me, like, hey, so I don't get upset. Because we were kind of close. We were really close. The roots were deep. And she had told me, like, I accepted this new job, and so I'm going to be leaving. And I was just like, oh, my God. Because that kind of coincided with me graduating from graduate school, which, you know, after you graduate from graduate school, you're just like, fuck, I need a job, you know? And so all of a sudden I started panicking. And her leaving basically coincided with the state budget crisis. It was, like, perfectly timed, because what ended up happening was the university, you know, there was, like, these furloughs that were implemented, and then, like, they put a hiring freeze on, like, certain leveled positions, and that was one of them. So even if they wanted to hire someone new, they couldn't. And while she had moved on, she curated a bunch of shows, like, that I would have to follow through on.
Right.
And there was a point where it was like, hey, we don't have, like, a fourth show. And I was just kind of like, I wonder what's going to happen. And so finally, like, the executive director was like, hey, we don't have a fourth show. And do you have any ideas? And so I always have ideas, you know? So I just kind of bounced off a few. We did one. You know, she was really into it. And then during that summer, because the gallery is kind of usually on hiatus for the summer for maintenance, you know, she'd ask, do you have any ideas for the following year, for the next season? I'm like, sure. And so I just presented them, and they, you know, she was, again, like, really happy with the exhibitions, how they turned out. And then I kind of just slipped into the position. Meanwhile, I should say, for that whole, like, year and a half where Julie had already left, and then we were kind of going into that first season without her, I couldn't go to an opening without, like, somebody asking me, like, so what's happening with that position? What's going on? I mean, and it got to the point where it was really uncomfortable, because, I would get really, like, vitriolic stares, like, because, you know, people were really gunning for that position. It's a good gig. It's a great space.
Yeah.
And
would you say generally that the people who were asking were curators or artists?
No, curators. But young emerging curators.
So let's just put this in larger context. So here's an artist who's potentially taking this spot when you've got a very finite number of good curatorial positions, and there are a ton of LA curators, right?
Totally. And
so this explains the vitriolic stares.
Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, like, and I would tell the truth, which is, like I said, they, even if they wanted to hire someone, they couldn't. And that was for, that hiring freeze was for, like, a really long time.
Did it ever occur to you why there was this freeze and what the source of it was?
No. No.
So you weren't navel gazing in that way?
No. I mean, at the time, I seriously needed, like, a job. And so, like, the first year was a critical year for me. And it was, because it was a test whether I could balance both things, like my own practice and run this space. And so I very consciously sort of decided that, like, because my first year running that space was also the first year I had my first proper solo show in New York. And
so everything was happening for you.
It was, but I wouldn't say it was like a happy time.
Why not?
Because, you know, I think there was, because this was the first year, the space was entirely on me. It was like tremendous, a lot of pressure. And then there was also the pressure of, like, this first, like I said, solo show in, like, New York. And so I had decided, like, if that show kind of crashed and burned, that I would have to, like, basically quit, because my identity is an artist and, like, not the job, you know? And so if my practice had taken a backseat to the job, that would have been really depressing to me. And so it was, like I said, it was a real test. Like, I tell people that and they don't believe me. Like, they're like, you know, seriously, you would have quit? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would have, I mean, I know myself well enough to know, like, I'm aware of certain triggers and like would kind of make me sort of sad and depressed. And that would have been like, if that first show like failed, it would have, I would have quit easily.
So it was a litmus test as to whether or not this was possible.
Then, you know, once that first year passed, I knew all the variables involved that I was able to like kind of get ahead of it. And it was sort of really sort of manageable. And because, you know, I think the thing too was when I was working with Julie, I think she protected me a lot with about like all the bureaucracy involved with like working with the university and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was tough the first year. And then, you know, every year I sort of create new rules. And this goes back to your original question. So like one of my rules, I think after a year and a half there, was like, I will not do a group show with more than 8 people. Because we did one and it was like 15 or 16 and it was just an absolute like nightmare and I will not do it again. And it's made me a better artist because like I mean, it was weird. I was like chasing down people.
Before you tell us more about what happened, one of my rules is you get a, and I'm sorry I didn't mention this in the guidelines, but I always like to save it for the room. You get a word allotment use of the word practice. Mm-hmm. So you reach your allotment, just so you know.
I did say practice twice.
You said practice twice, yes.
I did.
Yes. Most people are typically very unconscious.
That
you're,
makes me...
You've used it a healthy number of times. I'm just putting it out there.
No, but that's good to know. I mean, I didn't... if you had asked me, I would have said, like, I didn't even say it.
I say it all the time.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so my question is... I don't know if it's, you know, if it's now ancient history for you, but what happened with that show with 16 artists, essentially?
It was just like a nightmare. And I think it didn't turn out the way I had hoped. I think conceptually, I was still very much into the idea, but I ended up like running around for like chasing down artists.
And, to get you everything that you needed in order to do your job.
And I was kind of like, I'm not into this.
Let's talk about that for a second. Deb can definitely weigh in on this because there is this occasional thing. I mean, you know, in the upper, more professional levels, it probably presumably doesn't happen that much. But in the sort of general art landscape in any city, I would imagine, you have artists who are picked for shows, you know,
right.
Or artists who are recommended by other artists. And those artists who are given these opportunities flake big time. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? First of all, do you agree? And second of all, why do you think that is?
Actually, I don't know. Because there have been, in the beginning, because this is another thing that's changed. In the beginning, I did work with a lot of outside curated shows. Like I worked with like curators that I was interested in working with. And but now that's like, I don't do that anymore. And for that reason, because I don't like know these artists. I mean, one particular show, it involved a lot of recent MFA grads. I don't want to say which schools, but it was just...
But you were asking for trouble by doing recent grads, right?
Well, no, this was an outside curated show. But I there was something I was kind of like, huh, like I was just really blown away because these are people that I more or less graduated with at the same time. But just different schools and the sort of, I was kind of blown away by like the expectations. I was just kind of like, wow, man, like, why would you think we'd have that? Like, I mean, some of the requests were like just unbelievable.
Like, and there's a real, I also think there's a real lack of consciousness for certain people coming out of school who have not had any experience working on the administrative or curatorial side at all. Of what it entails and how huge a difference it can make in terms of the ability to smoothly put together what you hope is going to be an exceptional exhibition, to have to show up to things on time and have reasonable expectations. And it really does make it, it's not just a little thing. Like if it's a major group show, it makes a big difference in terms of what you can do in terms of the overall success of what you're doing.
No, I was blown away because there were like a lot of there was like really good artists in the show, and but basically like I had like one artist And that, if you're familiar with the space, it's big.
Yeah.
This is not like a small space where you can conceivably install the entire show like in an afternoon.
Right.
It's a big space. And then like, so, you know, usually with that space, I like to have everything installed Wednesday and then we light Thursday and then Friday, you know, just kind of touch up or whatever. And this one particular artist came like on a Thursday, the opening Saturday, asking me to like fabricate something. I was like, you're crazy. I was like, no. Like, this is.
I kind of wonder if the more to make obvious associations, if the more entitled / expectant students were ones that were coming from more entitled schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder which one that would be. Okay, just wanted to check.
But yeah, no, for sure. But it was, and then. I was really blown away because I was like, it's Thursday. No, there's no way I'm going to do this. And then I was just kind of like, the way the piece ended up getting installed in the end, I was just really sort of like, wow, man, you couldn't even like, at least like make some sort of attempt to get something similar to what you had expected, but instead like presented it in this way that was just kind of like, it's like, why present it at all? Like, it was that kind of sort of sad and sort of pathetic. And
let's get back to what you were talking about earlier as far as, because if I heard you right, it sounded like you said you like to work with artists you know.
Oh,
generally now. I don't know if that's not necessarily a rule, but did I hear that right?
Oh, no. Yes and no. I mean, when like I worked with like saying, I like to have like some sort, like I don't need to know them, but I maybe like some sort of, at least some sort of middle person or someone that can vouch for someone, you
right,
know?
Right.
But yeah, so like that's, I kind of like stopped like doing that. But no, I've done exhibitions with people I've like never heard of. And for the most part.
But you had a middle person who vouched for them.
Yeah.
Right.
Or just, I mean, probably one of my, yeah, no, I guess, yes, there's always been like some sort of middle person.
So what would be I hope this isn't too remedial for people listening, but what would be some of the questions that you would ask the art, you know, your connection about the potential artist who's going to be in the show?
Well, that's, I would never really ask questions. Like, I mean, but I could tell you like what I've heard other curators ask other curators, which is, how are they to work with? That's nothing. That's
sure.
Nothing, that's
that simple.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a really high threshold for like for crazy. So like that's with the exception of one time, like that's never sort of been like an issue with me. So people that like maybe have a reputation for being difficult, I've like I don't really have a.
That's not necessarily mean a no go for them.
For me, at least, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, because you know I've been there. I get it. You know. And I think what ends up happening too, like what's happened a lot of the times, is artists maybe familiar with my work, that sort of kind of makes it a little bit more relatable. And then the sort of, they kind of dial down the craziness.
So in other words, they see you as an artist and something in their DNA goes, you know, I'm an artist too. If I were in this situation, I wouldn't want somebody fucking around with me.
Oh, absolutely. I'm for the most part, I'm always on the side of, I would say 99.9% of the time, I'm always on the side of the artist. And whatever it is that they want to do, I let them do. Or try my very best to sort of make that happen.
But they need to do it in a timely fashion. They can't show up on Thursday before Saturday and say, can you make this for me?
Well, if I know what I'm getting into, I've definitely done the extreme. I mean, I've definitely done some gambles. I mean, in one instance, somebody who was helping me out.
I feel like we're really leaving out a lot of names here. This is like a very abstract conversation, which is okay. But
I could use proper names. There was this. A young artist who was helping me on one of my projects. His name's Andrew Lewicki, who showed, I think you mentioned Charlie James, has exhibited with him. And he was a guy just helping me out. And then he happened to show me some sketches. And I'm like, these are really I'm really into these. And we had an open slot, and I just got a vibe from the guy. Like, he didn't have anything made. There was nothing tangible. It was just like it was completely just ideas. And I got a vibe, and I'm like, hey, do you think you can feasibly like crank this out like in this amount of time? And knowing that it was going to be up into the last, potentially up into the last moment, it didn't give me like anxiety. And you know, this guy who virtually had like nothing produced all this work. I think he installed the last piece like maybe like 4 hours before the opening. I wasn't like tripping or having anxiety, because like I said, I was in the know-how from the beginning. And he killed it. Like the documentation.
So we're using sales terms in the art world now?
He crushed it. I mean, the work really, these things that were just like drawings and ideas, like
right.
I was blown away. I mean,
well, the takeaway for me, and Deb, I want to hear what your takeaway is that you can't ever overestimate the value of working in the field to getting those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah.
By working in the field, you mean
being, you know,
assisting,
preparing, working in a gallery, whatever, yeah. Which of course is, you know, I may have a future conversation with gallery preparators, but I mean, to me, that's hell. So I would rather not do that and not miss out on some of those opportunities than live that life. But this guy who's helping you out, that sounds like a very different situation. Because, I mean, you are a very different institution than a commercial gallery.
Yeah. Like, yeah, we're in like a nonprofit space. Yeah.
And you have a very different vibe. I presume, by the way, that you have at some point along the way, in addition to working for the Norton Collection, worked at commercial galleries? Here and there, or not so much?
Not commercial, mostly like nonprofit spaces. Like I've done years ago. Well, actually more like freelance stuff,
right?
Like fabrication work,
which you can do outside of the gallery.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Deb, I want to hear though what, you know, when you heard that story about that artist, what you thought of.
I think I've probably said this before, but I think that being a person in space and forming relationships is pretty much always the best way to get opportunities across the board, particularly in a time when, you know, we rely so much on digital communication, but everything feels like junk mail. It is so hard to feel like you can delineate what is real versus what is not. Not that those categories necessarily even mean anything, but the person who is in your space helping you, that you have a nice relationship with, not necessarily helping you, maybe it's somebody who shows up to events and doesn't just do it because they immediately want to ask you for something, but is actually feels like they're out there supporting what you're doing and your artists and your shows. I feel like those people are always going to get a certain amount of consideration. You know, it may take me a while to do a studio visit with somebody, but if somebody comes to my openings all the time and is supporting that way, and, you know, there's a good chance I'm much more likely to want to make that happen for them.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Sage. Free advice. That's what we're all about. So where were we?
You were talking about nonprofit spaces you work for. I guess one of the things that I'm kind of interested in is, so in that first year when you had this is it, or I'm going to quit the job and mm-hmm. find something else, what was the balance that you found? And what was the idea of success for you going to be in terms of the gallery show? And what does it continue to be for you in terms of your work as an artist that allows you to feel like, you know, the full-time curating job isn't taking away from it?
I mean, for me, like in terms of like success, it's always about like the work. Let me backtrack a little bit. But that, I think that was like 2009. So that was kind of like a really defining year, because at that time, just before the season had started at the gallery, I had I sort of overextended myself mm-hmm. in terms of like shows. Like right. I just, and this is still a bad habit. Like a friend jokingly said, I have to have like a sort of shock collar. So like when dates are mentioned, that I'd get a shock, and it's like, look at a calendar, because like this happens all the time. Like I had like something like four shows within a 2-week period. In one instance, like two shows opened the same night.
Right.
And it was it was all new work. And at that time, because you're a recent grad, you really don't feel like you're in the position to say like no to things.
I was gonna say, do you think though that at the same time that you're getting such a big introduction was because, you know, you were being launched out and therefore, you know, the eyes were on you for these opportunities?
Yeah, no, I mean, I literally, at that time, I seriously felt like I couldn't say no.
Yeah.
That's completely different now because, like, but at that time, like I said, there was a moment.
Right.
I was stretched so thin.
But when you're not answering, I'm actually asking, why did you get all those opportunities? What I was wondering is because you were just coming out of school, and so this is like, we want to get on this guy's train now.
Well, I had done maybe two or three projects that were getting a lot of traction, and one in particular that I produced during graduate school that primarily existed through documentation, but kind of because it was like a site-specific installation, and you know, the images got tossed around, and so
people were excited about it.
Yeah, and so there was interest, and I sort of felt like I couldn't really say no to these opportunities, and so I took it all on, and then but like I really when it all happened at the end of it, I thought I was really going to die, and I'm not joking, because I just had not slept. I wasn't taking care of myself. And then, you know, I just kind of like reevaluated. Like,
so it's funny because on one hand, I want to be universal about this. And a lot of this is very universal. But at the same time, I want to know, you had four shows at once out of school. Where were these venues? Each one of them.
Well, at that time, it was at Cottage Home, which I think now is Human Resources, is the old the theater.
Right.
There was one at Cottage Home. One was
Los Angeles,
and then one was the very, very first exhibition of Tom Solomon when he opened that space.
Right.
So I was in the inaugural exhibition.
Okay. Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. There was one at the Armory,
mm-hmm.
and then one called Artist Curated Projects, and they were all they were all within a 2-week period.
Okay, so got it. But I'm wondering about, because you had mentioned back at the beginning the New York show that you had at the same time as you were, you know.
So that was 2010. So, like, that's what I'm saying. So those shows were, like, kind of May, June, like June of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then the season typically starts in September.
Right.
And then the solo show was March of 2010.
At
Simon Preston Gallery in New York.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
And so, like, the season started in September, and my exhibition was that upcoming March. And and after that experience with the four exhibitions, I just kind of decided like I can't like I have to be, especially with the first year approaching with the gallery.
Yeah.
I couldn't. Luckily, I don't remember saying no. So like I think the things just kind of like things kind of just hit a lull, which was great because then I could concentrate on just the solo exhibition.
I hope, by the way, that and Deb, tell me what if you felt anything. But when you said I felt like I was gonna die,
no, I really felt like I was gonna die.
Yeah, no, and I laughed at that because I guess it sounded so absurd. But I didn't mean to, you know, take away from the pain you were going through. But it's funny because you have just put up a show, and we can plug it more later. But you've spent, you know, 20 hours a day for like a week, pretty much putting that up.
Yeah, no, that one was extreme. Like that, I haven't. That one, I think I told you, I finished 90 minutes before the opening. But I wasn't, the thing. I don't think I could have done that in 2009.
Right.
No,
right.
I couldn't.
You have a more stable life now.
Definitely. And there's just certain things I don't have, a threshold for anymore. And, I think either 2011 or 2012, I had worked on another show which involved, collaborating. It was my first proper video project, and you know I worked with another artist, Terry Chatkup, and that experience was just like a game changing moment for me, because I think up until that point, like every time I'd worked on a show, it was always this very torturous experience, and then I worked on this one, and this guy's so chill, so together. And I was just like, wait, why, you know, like, why am I killing myself all the time? And it just ended up being this very pleasant experience. And I think after that show, like, my approach to, like, shows, it's like, I don't know, my attitude is like, kind of like, oh, well. Like, I mean, up before that, like, every time I'd work on a show, it was like this sort of end of the world mentality. But in 2000, I really, like, I'm not joking. I'm not being hyperbolic.
Right, right.
I really thought I was going to die. I mean, I went to the doctor. I started, like, exercising. Like, I was just, like, it was...
Because you were overworking.
I was overworking, but I really thought, like...
And you were overstressing.
Overstressing. I would go to bed convinced I wouldn't wake up the next morning, you know? So...
What are the ways that you take care of yourself, Marco?
What? Now, I just... like I said, the things that I used to stress about, I don't stress about anymore.
Like, it feels like you shifted your perspective so that
yeah.
you
can. Yeah. And I mean, going back to your early question, like, it's always, and even more now, it's at the end of the day, it's about the work. Like, I mean, there were things that I used to, like, these things that I once at one point thought was important. Like, I mean, I think maybe in 2009, I was like, you know, part of the reason I said no to those things was maybe I was thinking, like, oh, I really, you know, I need to get my foot in the door. I need to get a gallery. I need a, you know, representation. And then I realized, like, that stuff is not important to me.
But, you know, the irony, though, is that even though you killed yourself and you would never do that now, it probably was, don't you think it ultimately was, in retrospect, a good investment to have all those things going on and having sort of been featured in those venues?
Yes and no, because ultimately I'd sort of been asked to be part of a gallery as a result of that, and I had to say no, because I couldn't realistically see myself running the gallery and working for an artist working for a gallery in New York and working for a gallery in LA. I couldn't see, and I'm not.
Oh, you were asked to work for a gallery, not
no,
show
like
in a gallery,
show at a gallery in LA.
Oh, okay.
And I said, I said
so
no.
So you had essentially New York representation.
Yeah,
you were being asked for LA representation. You were like, that's too much.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. Not at that time. I mean, I don't have any regrets of that, because at that time I can't even think how I could have done it. And also, I'm not that kind of artist that, like, I'm not like a machine. Like, the work I kind of produce, it doesn't, like, I'm not one of those that goes into the studio every day and makes a mark, you know? Like, my practice is pretty much like 8 months of, sorry, my work.
Good catch.
I pretty much spend, like, maybe, well, now it's different because I'm a lot busier, but before, it used to be maybe 8 months of, like, watching TV and, like, reading books and going to movies and stuff like that in 4 months of, like, production.
Right.
You know, I only work as the ideas come to me. I don't, like, I don't go into a room or my studio and just, you know, try to crank out stuff.
But as far as scheduling, this show that you just put up now here, you plan that as on a down cycle at the Luckman Gallery, right?
Yes and no. This is one of those instances where I should have looked at a calendar, because it was that I was kicking myself over that, because the timing of it was just absolutely stupid. But I think I realized, because I kept asking myself, why did I do this? Like, why did I like this? And I think I realized, because I didn't know if it was like hubris or like cockiness or. But then I think I found the answer, which was, when I had originally been asked to do the show, it was for April, which was a flat-out no, because I started teaching at UCLA, and I had the gallery still in season. And so it was just like, no way. April, it's not going to happen. And so as a alternative, like, June was presented. And I think I was just simply reacting to it not being April. So I'm like, hey, it's not
months.
April. It's not April. June's good. Let's do it. Let's do June. And then again, I didn't look at a calendar, because then I would have noticed that like install would have coincided with our very last install exhibition at the Luckman and finals at UCLA. So it was just,
oh my God.
And so I was just like, why? Like, why did I, you know? But luckily I was able to push the opening a week, and that made like a huge difference. But But yeah, like I would, if I have one regret, it's probably that I was just like, because there was no urgency with that show, and I know the people that work there, and I think I think they would have been cool if I was like, hey, I can't really do it. How about like maybe later in the year, you know? So that's the only part where I was just like, why did I like, God, you know, like, because I think it definitely like, it was stressful. It was stressful.
Hmm. Aside from the insanity of scheduling, do you feel like the curatorial work and your work as an artist feed into each other in a really nice way? I mean, when I hear you talk about how a big part of the way you work is kind of digesting for a long time and then particular periods of production, it seems like it could be sort of happily symbiotic with...
No, absolutely. I realized like maybe after the first year that when I didn't try, the show, the exhibitions kind of curated themselves.
Right.
And like, I'll give you a perfect example. Like I had gone, I visited a friend in Philadelphia who's working at the ICA, and you know, visit was personal. Like I was like, hey, I want to see my friend. And, she had told me she was running behind and was like, hey, why don't you check out the exhibition while I pack up my things.
Right.
And I kind of entered the exhibition through the wrong direction. And I was just like, again, I was just like floored. I was like looking at this exhibition. I'm like, man, this is like an amazing, amazing show. And so when I came out, what I thought was the end, and which was actually the entrance, I sort of read the didactic, the wall text, and saw the artist, and I was actually kind of like embarrassed. I wasn't really familiar with the artist because it was an LA-based artist.
Yeah.
And after walking through the exhibition, I was familiar with like two or three works, but I was so floored by the work. And I think because I had done it backwards, it felt like a lot of the work I was seeing just, it felt like new work.
Right.
And when I saw that all this work was actually done 20, 30 years ago, I was just like, whoa, what? You know, because I feel like there was a lot of artists trying to make that work now.
Yeah.
And this artist did it 20, 30 years ago. And so...
For any reason, we're not talking.
Yeah, we could say Jennifer Blondie. And so my friend came out, and who's also another great artist. Her name's Alex Klein. And I was just like, man, this show is amazing. Like, and then I sort of asked. I was like, so is this show traveling to L.A.? Because, I mean, she's an instructor at L.A. She's based in L.A. And I was like blown away that it wasn't. Like, it basically, the ICA was the last stop.
Yeah.
And the following day, I asked her, I go, hey, you know, can I ask you a question? Like, how far-fetched do you think it would be to, like, if we try to get this show to the Luckman? And she's like, I think it would be a great idea. And she sort of got the ball rolling. And I've never worked for like trying to get a show that hard. But that was, like I said, completely serendipitous.
Right.
It was and so that's what I've learned too. Like if I actively try to look for artists to show and stuff, it always backfires. And but if I just go through my normal, like,
and it finds you.
It all finds me. And that was, for me, that was a huge, really important show, and one that I'm extremely, extremely proud of. And I've never fought for a show so hard because, you know, like it was, I mean, it came from the ICA, you know.
Isn't it true, though, that the serendipitous elements of curating, it's much more likely to happen as you're further along? In other words, when you were at the beginning doing the 16-person show, you know, and for any curator who's sort of early on, they just don't have maybe enough friction to really have that kind of serendipity for shows to come together, unless they're just like out and about, you know, and networking all the time.
Well, I've seen like those that, you know, that I see them everywhere, and it's like I could see them like
the vitriolic
actively,
people.
No, actively like networking, you know? But being an artist, like I at a certain point, I just kind of like being an artist, you always meet other artists. And then those artists have friends, and then, you know, and like I said, that for the most part, that I've been very fortunate in that way. But yeah, like I just noticed when I try, like it just never works out.
Right, right.
Well, and as you said before, people give you the benefit of the doubt because they don't second guess your intentions as someone who is also a practicing artist, I think, in a different way, maybe, than, yeah, if that makes sense.
What do you think?
No, yeah, definitely makes sense. Well, I think, I mean, going back to, I mean, I can't speak for her, but I definitely, this is the vibe I definitely got when I finally met with Jennifer face to face and I showed up to her door. There was a moment in the conversation where it completely, like, I think there was a tonal shift, because at one point she asked me, she goes, she'd recognize me from one of my own videos and that scene, the show. And it completely, like I said, she, all of a sudden, the whole attitude kind of changed. Because she's, I think, like,
what,
I said.
So what did it go from to?
Well, it was more like a sort of curator-artist dynamic to, I think, more like a peer.
You're right. One of my people.
Yeah. And, but like I said, I can't verify, but that's what I definitely felt. Like, there was a moment in the conversation where she had asked me, like, did you do this video a couple years ago at LAX? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, yeah, I saw that video. And she described it to me. Like, so she definitely saw the video. And, like, everything kind of changed at that moment.
Yeah, I would say there's probably the least amount of suspicion directed towards great artist curators than other types
of curators. Who are you thinking?
Who am I thinking of? I just mean that I think that this is just me observing social interaction more than anything else, and the same way that I am sometimes very jealous of artists who get to trade with each other, I am also often jealous of artist curators who have that kind of natural dynamic and don't necessarily have to overcome the... No, I really do actually identify with you and want what is best for your work kind of bridge that I think dealers generally have to cross.
It doesn't feel like there are that many of them, though, are there?
That many artist curators?
Yeah. Name one other than Marco.
Well, no, there actually is one who, like, largely, I sort of kind of, in a weird way, sort of modeled myself after, which I mentioned him earlier, is Julio Cesar Morales. Kind of, he was based in SF, and he actually gave me my first solo show after straight out of grad school, and ran this, like, artist run space called Queen's Nails, that was next to, like, a nail shop called Queen's Nails in San Francisco in the Mission, and he, like, sort of personifies for me, like, the artist curator, and so he did the. He's the one that I was saying was doing curatorial work at Yerba Buena, and then invited me and this other artist, Kara Tanaka, to do a show there. And he, like, again, it's kind of similarly, like, just this. I've noticed sometimes with, like, some, oh man, this might get me in trouble, but with talking with certain, sometimes with curators, like, curators really often, they don't have imagination. So when you describe ideas, they can't wrap their brains around it. Like, they really like to see something sort of finished.
See, this is where being general is very helpful.
and what do you call it? And that doesn't happen with, like, when you're working with, like, another artist. And oftentimes we're, like I said, in the instance with Andrew Lewicki, like, I got it. I can totally visualize it without having to see it in front of me. I just, like, in that instance, a lot of it was primarily, like, a vibe, you know, but I'd seen other things that he was capable of, because, like I said, he was helping me, and so I could see what his skill set was, so I just knew that, like, oh, this guy can do it, or if he tells me he can do it, I believe he can do it, and so he did. But that, like, is very rare, like, in the instance with him. Like, I don't know if that would have happened any other way.
Right.
I'm not just talking about people who are in Marco's position and actually necessarily have a space that they run, although I do think there are a number of artist-run spaces that happen in LA and then maybe shift to commercial spaces or shift in different ways. But I'm also just artists curating shows in general, which I think happens probably more here than it does in a lot of other places because there's more room made for it. But anyways, just a little side note clarification.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
And I love artist spaces, like artist run space. I will take an artist run. If I've given two opportunities, I will take the artist run space because.
Now, what would you say to a dealer whose name I won't mention, who described artist spaces as not to be taken particularly seriously? His sort of rationale being, if I can remember right, you know, that artists are picking other artists and they kind of don't have any perspective. You know, so he was elevating the dealer and curator in terms of their having perspective. But when it's artists showing other artists, you know, in an artist run space, there's this sort of conflict of connection, you know what I mean?
Right.
Et cetera. How do you feel about that?
I could understand where that person's coming from, but from an artist perspective, it's hard to talk about without talking about a recent experience.
Go for it.
I did a project in Vienna, which was an artist-run space. And it was the single most best art experience of my career. And there was absolutely no, like money tied to it. It was like... And I at the time, I really had wanted to do a project that wasn't affiliated with, like, a commercial space. And I just wanted to do something kind of site specific. And over the years, I've become friends with two Viennese artists. Sorry, mm-hmm, not Viennese.
Mm-hmm. It's Viennese. Okay.
And I was gonna go visit them, and I had asked them like months before, like, hey, you know, like when I was years ago when I went to Berlin, you know, people kept talking about these like vacant spaces, like squatter spaces, and I thought, like, I was like, is there any spaces like that in Vienna where I can potentially like just go there and do a project and just invite a few people and, you know, just document it, you know? And they were like, no, unfortunately, like, Vienna's not sort of set up that way. So I was like, okay, well, then in that case, when I visit you, it'll just be like a vacation. And so, and then about a month later, I got a call from one of them. They're like, hey, we talked to a friend who runs the space, and he was really into your idea. Would you be interested? He goes, but, you know, it's an artist-run space, so there's, like, no money. And I was just like, don't care. I'm going to do it. And I'll find a way. And usually whenever I sort of commit to an idea, things... I mean, I hope this doesn't jinx it, but things sort of fall into place. Like, all of the, you know, I didn't necessarily have the money to go and for the budget, but then all of a sudden... completely out of left field, I'll get a call for like a fabrication job or something like, and you know, this is like, it'll be a year since I've gotten like call or whatever, and came up with the money, went, they put me in touch with like a guy that helped me install along with the artist that sort of brought me there. And at a certain point, because it involved a lot of construction, because it was like sort of like an intervention on the architecture. And at a certain point, like they had, it was crunch time, and they had other artists sort of came in and started helping with the install, artists I've never met before. And then even after that, like cousins of the artists were coming in to help me like finish this piece. And it was just like this really amazing like experience. Like, I was just like, wow, what's going on? And then at a certain point, because I still was suffering from jet lag, because I literally landed and went, within like a few hours, was like with a hammer in my hand and like just building out this stuff. They were like, you know, take a day off. We'll, you know, sleep. You know, everything at this point is kind of touch up. Like, we'll finish it and then we'll pick you up the next day. I mean, we'll drive you here then tomorrow and you could take a look at it. And so that's what happened. I slept, and then the next day they drove me to the space, and I nearly got teary eyed because it was like this idea that I've had in my head for like 8 years, and it was like better than I had imagined. It was almost like that space was made for this specific project, and for reasons that I couldn't quite articulate at that moment, it was more successful than if it had been like done here. The fact that it was like in Vienna,
right. Because
I guess their first, basically what I had, is like I sort of lowered like the ceiling to like my height. It was a very minimal piece, and it was kind of like the antithesis of this earlier piece that was very theatrical. And no, and it was amazing. And like this, and then when the opening came around, I was just sort of shocked because like I'm from LA, I don't know anybody there except the, like these two people I know. But I was very happy with the piece. And then strangely, like it was one of the best attended openings in this like artist run space's history.
Hmm.
Like, that made no sense. And
why do you think that was?
I think because across the street from there, there was a bar called the Black Cat that had like weekly raids, either for like prostitution or drugs or whatever. And so the guy who ran the space was kind of really into the piece as he saw it sort of being built. And then on Facebook said something to the effect of like, the owner of the Black Cat says this is the best exhibition all year. And so
that's fantastic.
Good marketing.
So I don't know. I mean, I like to think that did something, but I have no explanation for it, to be honest. What was
the piece called?
That one was called Symmetrical Spleen. And it was like, no, it was just like every part of it was like magical.
Would you largely chalk that up to the Viennese art community? Or?
Well, I would chalk that up to just like, I think Europe in general, they just,
they get it.
They respect and treat artists like well, you know?
For that.
Yeah.
And no, but there was just tremendous freedom. At one point, it's just like you're handed the keys. And it's just, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's like for me, it's always about the work. And so I just got to make the piece I wanted to make I wasn't working under a microscope. Like the guy would just like check in every once in a while. How's it going? Like wouldn't be tripping out. Like there's just like a lot of freedom in artist-run spaces.
Do you feel like the kind of nature of your work and also having this job that is, you know, at a great nonprofit space doing this in combination with each other has in some ways allowed you to sort of shield yourself from some of the less appealing commercial elements of what's going on in the art world parallel to that?
Yeah, I would think so. I would definitely think so. And then, like, I mean, in terms, because now, like I said, now that I have a couple years behind me, like, when I'm not working on a show, there is tremendous satisfaction. Like, because now what I try to do more with the gallery is I try to do more solo shows and try to work and try to produce work that's, like, new rather than existing. So, like, people are directly responding to the space. And, you know, I just want, like, the work. I prefer that the work, if it's going to be local or, like, a local artist or an artist maybe more under the radar or... I rather, like, now use that space as a space where, like, original work is made versus, like... you know,
dealing with something that's already been.
Yeah. And so, like, even though I didn't produce the work, it just, it felt very gratifying.
Right, right.
So then what brought you out before we started recording? You mentioned that you went out to Frieze this year for.
Thank you, Deb.
The fairs. What what brought
yeah,
you
why,
out there?
What were you doing at Frieze?
This is more like when I, like, maybe not necessarily researching with, like, what's in the booths,
right.
But I end, like, inevitably, like, I bump into people, and then it's that same thing. Like, I get introduced to somebody, and this, you know, and with these, with the a few art fairs, I can go through work, and
with, so you went in your guise as curator,
yeah, and
clever,
and and I was really curious because this was the third year or the second.
It's the third year.
It was the third year, and I had not been to Frieze New York, and I have to say I wasn't grossed out by it. I was kind of into it. In the
high praise, indeed. And Deb, were you not grossed out by it either?
I was not grossed out by it. It's very pretty. I mean, you know, and that sounds like the like,
right.
You know, damning with faint praise, but it is. They do a great job of creating a context that is, you know, extremely high ceilings for the tent. It's all open, and it feels less.
It's manageable.
Yeah,
like you can feasibly go do Frieze and like 3 hours or less.
Yeah.
And unlike Miami, where it's like you would, it would, to feasibly see everything in Miami, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
In the amount of days that it's like up.
Right, right.
It's less of the nightmare of the shopping mall that it's pretending kind of not to be. It feels more like an exhibition experience.
Ferry. It was nice. It was
ferry
nice.
Is cool. Go over the
and,
water.
And I don't, yeah, it was just very like manageable.
Have a
I didn't like
$12 I was vegan really, parfait.
Yeah, I was really I was really surprised by it. I didn't know what to expect really, but it wasn't that. I was like, oh man, this is not what I thought.
It's really nice when you kind of have relatively low expectations or low in a particular way for yourself and you get shocked out of them a little bit. It's, yeah, that's good when that happens. It doesn't.
Yeah, because when I did Miami the year before, that was like unbearable. It was like absolutely unbearable.
Because you had work in it?
Well, yeah, I had a project there. But I realized, like, Miami's fun. I realized only because that year, I had an unusually lot of friends that were there with projects. Mm. And like I think something like Miami, it's only fun when you're there with other like other artists and other friends. But because I've been to fairs where I've been by myself and it's, you know.
It's a nightmare.
You want to kill yourself.
Well said, yeah.
And but having friends there just made Miami like so much more fun.
Sure.
But yeah, no, but that one in particular, I was not prepared for how overwhelming it was because that was my first time in Miami and I was just like, wow.
It's intense.
So why don't we sort of wrap by go ahead and, you know, giving you the plug that you've earned now for your show.
I mean, we don't have to.
It's at Heck Gallery. What's the name of it again?
Beck
Gallery. B-A-I-C.
It doesn't look like it, though. It's B-A-I-K.
K. Yeah. Beck Gallery. And it's called Migraine Cabin, right?
Yeah.
If we don't want to, you know, give away too many spoilers. But the first question for that maybe people listening might have is, do you get migraines? Or is it strictly metaphorical?
I used to get really bad migraines. Used to.
How did they stop?
I think some people just outgrow them.
Yeah.
But I used to get them really bad. I mean, I remember being in high school and getting one really bad one, and like the like high school football, like, you know, like the guy, you know, the football guy in high school, you know, like the main dude, like was in class and had to carry me to my car. Like it was that bad.
Wow.
Yeah. Like it was.
That's quite an image.
It was an image.
Can we get a picture to go along with this episode of the high school football guy carrying you to your car? That would be awesome.
No, I mean, it was, I remember like they used to be really bad. I had to get like CAT scans and like, and then like I said, I think I just outgrew them.
Good timing because, you know, working 20 hours installing
yeah,
is not a good time to get migraines.
Not.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny because I don't know. I've had a couple instances where I've been carried a lot. Like that was one where the high school like football player or whatever carried me to my mom's car and like sent me, you know. And then I was telling, yeah, I don't know. The other ones aren't art related, but I've been carried a couple times.
That's okay. They don't have to be art related.
I know. Now we want to know.
My very first time in New York. My first trip. I didn't realize like. It was just so overwhelming and like amazing, and like I wish somebody had told me like, hey, you need a really good pair of shoes when you go because you're going to be doing a lot of walking.
Yeah.
And so I was just like walking constantly that first trip. Like I've never walked that much in my life, and so like I already when I went to New York, I went with my list, and
right.
restaurants, and one of them was I kind of did a search for best late night steak or something, right. And I went to this like late night steak place, and I was eating alone that night, and. All of a sudden, like the bill came and I got up and I just, it's like I had no legs. Like I think I just overexhausted my leg and I just collapsed. Like just like, you know. And I got along. For some reason, I was like really young at that time, and so the maitre d' or whatever, they were just kind of like really into that. It was my first trip to New York, and I was eating there, and so everything's like, hey, you know. So I was saying bye, like, oh man, the food was amazing. Oh my god, you know. And they gave me the check, and they're like, oh god, you got to come back. And then I get up to stand up, and I just like. Ah, like just like completely like no. collapse on the floor, and then like, you know, and you hear like the thud and then like glass shattering, you know.
Wow.
Oh, no.
And I couldn't walk. I couldn't even stand up. And then the maitre d' like called a cab. And, carried me, like, you know, with my legs over his, like,
yeah,
my legs were dangling over his forearms.
Right.
Like, just, like, placed me in the cab, and the cab, like, I think I maybe crawled into the hotel. Like,
so the cab driver didn't pick up his end of the, That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it was kind of hilarious. And then, like, I had to go, like, the next day, like, what's the store there? Like, Dwayne Reed, and, like, literally had to soak my feet in, like, bath salts or some Dr. Scholl's thing or something.
Right.
Never. And I think I was, at the time, like, it was, like, I was wearing, contrary to belief, like, you know, like, they were, because they're described as comfort shoes, but they're really not. Whereas at that time, because this was, like, I think, this was before 9/11, I was wearing, like, Doc Martens. And so, like, which were not, like...
Not cushiony for that much walking.
I've had some almost passing out from Doc Martens kind of experience in high school.
Yeah.
There's a thing.
Fashion.
Steel-toed.
Steel-toed, three-hole eyelet.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah, it's not good.
Black stitching. And, yeah, they were just not the most ideal shoe to be walking around in New York for, like, hours and hours and hours. And But
you might do okay if a car ran over your foot. So that's, you know, that's a thing.
Marco, thank you very much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Deb.
Yay.
And?
We're out.
Excellent. No hesitation. Thank you again to Marco and to Deb once again. And by the way, I asked Marco when he was carried off those two separate times into the sunset, what movie, if any, he thought of. And he said the movie Lucas. So just so you know. Before we go, one other thing that I wanted to share with you, and that is I'm looking for an intern. The Conversation Podcast is looking for an intern, but it's an intern with a producer track. So eventually I want to shape an intern into a producer for the show. And as a model, I would say look to Brendan McDonald, producer extraordinaire. And if you don't know who I'm referring to, look it up. But those of you who know exactly what I'm talking about, maybe you are the candidate or you know somebody who would make a good candidate, and I would love to hear from them. And the important thing about Brendan, just without getting into details, is that he does not live in the same place as his talent or the show that he is producing. So you can be anywhere in the country, possibly even Canada, and still be a candidate as an intern. So, love to hear from you, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much again for being here, and I will talk to you soon.